Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
On this episode, I am joined by the founder of The Bike Shed. It's the wonderful Dutch Van Someren.
This is the Big Jim Show.
Giddy up. Yeah.
Big Jim is wearing his heels, marching around the town to get some thrills. But it's time to go in now, and he's big and red. A shot of black coffee, now he's super dead. He gets loud, I'm a beer dick house. I showed him up some whiskey and he shoots like a ball.
It's all about a bitch, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's all about a bitch,
yeah. Let's get this rolling. Dutch, sure. you do the intro for you, sure. And then, because this is all going on, so sure. this is great.
Okay, well, my name's Dutch. I'm the co-founder with my wife, Vicky, of Bike Shed. I guess we've been running around trying to make a living out of motorcycles for a decade or so now. And yeah, really happy to be on this podcast.
Yeah, no, it's wicked to have you. And we were chatting a while about it. I think I followed you first on social media. And the reason was, for the listeners, I am a fair weather rider. Okay, so I've got a Harley. I'll go from coffee shop to coffee shop. That's as kind of rock and roll as it gets, but it looks great on Instagram. But another part of that, another layer on that, is when I come down to London, I've been going to the Bike Shed for the last couple of years. And every time I go there, I'm like, this is fucking the coolest place in the world. So I tell all my mates, like I tell, my wife's actually been there as well. And I was like, what is this? Like, I'm trying to work out, like, initially when I was there, what is it? You've got, like, some prime real estate in the middle of Shoreditch. It's massive. You've got old bikes knocking about. There's merchandise. There's food. There's drink. There's coffee. There's a barber's. There's a tattoo place. There's music on. I was like, I said to the missus, like, this, I could live in here. Like, this is me. This is, like, where I'm happy. So the fact that we're in the studio now and it's your place, so I did a little bit of digging, followed you. But to have you in the studio for what I think is one of the coolest brands in the UK is wicked.
No, thank you. Yeah. I really appreciate that. It's really kind. I mean, the Bike Shed's kind of reverse engineered from probably for people like you and me who like motorcycles. And as a lifelong rider, I don't know if I'm a biker. I've been riding bikes all my life. But as being a biker sometimes is a bit of a statement. But as a lifelong rider who spends most of my spare cash on motorcycles and related pastimes, I never really understood why motorcycle culture didn't evolve. It always seemed stuck in the 70s, and all these famous bike places were rooted in kind of bad customer experience and nowhere comfy to sit and bad food. And my wife Vicky rides, but she wouldn't come with me to some of those venues. And I'm not going to name them because I don't want to be rude and describe these venerable, amazing institutions for bike culture as being a bit shite, because they're great and I go to them. They're iconic, but you don't go there to hang out. You go there to look at bikes and kick tires and then leave. And I never really understood that. And I always thought, well, where's the really nice place? And you see with other sort of cultures like sports or vintage cars or other things, you see the hospitality culture and lifestyle and retail culture around those things evolving all the time. But it didn't for bikes. And I didn't want spit and sawdust and standing on a motorway cafe with a melting Kit Kat and a cold cup of tea. That wasn't really my vibe. Mm. And I was in media for a long time, for 28 years or so. And I was one of the very early members of Soho House when it was not full of wankers. And it was just one place in Greek Street above Cafe Bohème. And the manager went upstairs. I think Podge was the manager downstairs, went upstairs. And everyone was there because they were in media. They were creative people. They were writers and actors and lighting people and cameramen. And it was like a pub for media and TV people, but as a private members club. And you were united by the fact that you all were into creative. And I thought that was a really interesting model for biking, because if you go to a dodgy wedding and you're on one of the tables at the back and you've got no one to talk to because you don't really know anyone, and you discover someone on your table rides a bike, now you're buddies for life. That's it. That's your guy or your girl. You know, you find this common ground in people who love motorcycles, whatever level, whether they're fair weather riders on Harleys or sort of die hard sports bike riders who do track days. And so I kind of thought, well, if there was a destination or a place for bike riders, it would be like a big pop-up club. And it would be really comfortable. It would be a great place to be. And what spurred that thinking on was I was blogging about bikes in 2011, this whole cafe custom culture. My wife, Vicky, bought me this Ducati Sport Classic 1000, which is now this iconic motorcycle that you can't get anymore. And I was customizing it. And the blog thing had just started. Blogging was, you know, a sort of thing. And I started a blog called Full Tilt, and I was writing about customizing this bike, but loads of people in the creative industry were doing the same thing. A couple of guys I knew were photographers, Tim and Kev, and they had Spirit of the 70s, this amazing sort of bike custom shop, turning, you know, CB750s and Kawasaki Z650s into beautiful motorcycles with Ohlins and Brembo brakes and cool suspension, and went round corners. And we sort of ended up gathering together, and I said, well, I should blog for you guys as well, because to be honest, they were a bit lazy. And we called the blog The Bike Shed because we thought that sounded a bit funny. Bike Shed and Motorcycle Club seemed a bit like they didn't really fit. Your shed is where you hang out and talk crap, and Motorcycle Club sounded cool. And we hung out a lot. We used to drink a couple of pubs, one of them the Flask in Islington. And we'd turn up on our bikes. And one year we were talking about who's going to go to the bike show at the XL. And we were like, well, what for? And there were about 12 of us sitting around the table. And we were like, well, why would we go there? You know, it's full of, you know, the dealership's bikes that you can't buy yet. And none of them were inspiring at that time. They were more and more about sport or transport. They weren't about lifestyle, unless you bought a Harley. And the only girls there were sort of paid to be there in Lycra to get your data. So it was a sausage factory full of blokes squeezed into ill-fitting leathers, walking around kicking tires of dealer bikes they're not going to buy. And I thought, what's the point in that? And in a crappy venue, in the middle of the NEC, is not exactly a nice place to go, and with horrible food. And I didn't really get it. And we were sort of saying, well, what would, if we did a show, and, you know, we were all in media and events and kind of creating sort of, I suppose, experience for people. How would we do a show? And we sort of had a sort of beer-fueled brainstorm. And obviously, Vicky was a big part of it, going, well, really good food, comfy places to sit, you know, Chesterfield sofas. It would be like, she said, it would be like a man cave, you know, be full of awesome things. And we were like, well, all the bikes had to be curated and there wouldn't be any ropes because we'd trust our audience to not go and sit on a bike. And it wouldn't be about dealerships. It would be about custom bikes, and everything would be curated. And then we'd need amazing food, great bars. Maybe somebody wants to have a cocktail. You know, they don't just need a beer in a plastic cup. And then we go on to barbershops and tattoo pop-ups and art on the walls. And then I came back a week later and I said, right, I've booked a venue. Let's go.
So cool. Because being there, when you listen to you talk, you've kind of explained that you don't necessarily need to be a hard out rider or biker, which I'm not, but chatting to people just randomly in there, a lot of people go there and they've never been on a bike. They've never even touched a bike. And it's because it's cool, like it's a nice spot, because there's so many different offerings. And we will talk about the event at the Tobacco Dock, which is at the end of the May.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm right.
Our 13th show from that first show.
So cool. I took my lad there to look around, and it's like, it's more a reflection of me because it's the things that I'm into, but it's like music, like good coffee, merchandise, like cool pop-up shops, you know, like these kind of things, like as in creative people knocking around. And again, I've had a view on bikers, old school bikers, like Hell's Angels. Like, I'm big into them books and stuff like that. Sons of Anarchy. Do you know what I mean? Mm. So the Leathers. Maybe that's why I went down the Harley route. Maybe I was trying to tell myself something that I needed to be something that I wasn't. But this feels like it's a community that a lot of people need in life. A community.
Yeah.
And that's where I was drawn to it. So during COVID, just for reference, I had a bike in France in 2013. So just over 10 years ago. Had a Harley breakout. Only because it was the only bike that I could fit on. I'd drive around the south of France and felt a bit risky, like I wasn't 100% comfortable. One, I'm in France, wrong side of the road, and I've never really been on a bike. I didn't grow up with bikes and stuff like that, although I'd had interest in it. But riding on the road with the sun on your back, it was a happy place for me. And people have these busy creative minds. Like it's a place where I could be focused. I'd be thinking about the road. And then I left France and left the bike behind, give it to a mate. But I'd always think about it. So I'd always think, oh, I'd love to get a bike again. And like a lot of these things, it was during COVID where people wanted to leave their old jobs. I was going to open a coffee shop. Doing all these things, like thinking, like, what kind of things like make you happy? What do you have control of? And I kept going back to getting back on a bike again. I was digging, and this isn't what we were speaking about. I was trying to find podcasts. There weren't many to listen to people about different experiences. I know, like, Ewan McGregor and stuff had done his kind of mad cycle and stuff was on TV. But almost it did feel like a little bit kind of underserviced. Like, everything, like, there's loads of sport out there. There's podcasts about anything and everything, but nothing really on biking. And then I found the bike shed. I went in there. I was like, this is what it needs. Like, this is to spike interest, to bring everything together, to bring the music, to bring the food, to bring that kind of creative industry. That's why I got really excited when I followed you and we followed back. But being in there, it felt like it's a place that a lot of people need, and people like listening to this and digging deeper into it. Like, a lot of ex-military people ride, don't they?
Yeah, a lot, yeah.
And this comes on to my point. So having retired from sport, okay, and you're in that team environment, you're with the lads, and then you're out of it and it's done. Like, where do you fill that void? I'm not saying that I found that void by being in the bike shed, but some of the trips that I've done, I've got a couple of things planned. I've got a great trip in America that I'll talk to you about, actually. But I did a ride, what was it called, up in Aviemore. Glen, Ride of the Glen, the Harley ride. I don't know if you know what it is.
I don't actually know. There.
What's it called? It's called Thunder in the Glen. Right?
Perfect.
Thunder in the Glen. I'm surprised you've not heard of it. But that's the Harley thing, right? Mm. You know, and I really like the Harley Davidson brand. Like, Jason Momoa has made it look really cool, like the stuff on the beach and the stuff around the brand that they're doing. But I went there, and that was the first one that I went to, like, last year, where it was actually a ride out. They went, and I sort of, like, I felt it. I was like, you're part of a team, part of a community. You're doing something that isn't 100% safe. Do you know what I mean? Like, and I was like, this is it. This is what I need.
I think what you're expressing is something that so many people relate to, regardless. And it's a spectrum. There are people, I mean, for me, biking is about sort of escape. And I quite like riding on my own, actually, considering I'm somebody that's organising big groups. But I really like riding on my own. I like to just get on the bike. And, you know, I asked somebody what mindfulness was a while ago, and they were telling me about it. And I was like, oh, right, so that's motorcycling, right? You're in the moment. You can't really think about anything else. And all of your senses are taking in what's around you, the sights, the smells, the sounds, the feeling of what you're doing. And when you ride a motorcycle, you know, you can't just go daydreaming. You've got to pay attention to what you're doing. And the feeling of movement and the flow and the relationship between you and the machine and the road and even the weather conditions, you know, whether it's the sun on the back or the rain in your face, all of these things are really powerful things that humans crave. We crave real experience. And then you've got that next layer, which is camaraderie and friendship and community, where when you find other people that like the same thing, doing it with those people turns it into community. And then you add on destination. And when you add on destination, then it becomes about adventure. Well, where are you going? Are you going to see places you've never seen? There's a big difference between getting on a plane and flying to Lisbon than there is getting on a bike and riding to Lisbon. You're going to feel every inch of the road on that journey, and you're going to, you know, go through sort of mountains and fields and villages, and you're going to stop along the way. And so biking fulfills so many things for so many people, even before you get into sport and speed or cruising and checking out the view. There are so many layers which people find thrilling and exciting and attractive. And And then the other layer, the sort of the layer on top of all that, is people who don't ride think it's cool. I mean, there's a reason why every James Bond film and every Jason Bourne film and every Tom Cruise film needs their hero on a motorcycle for some of that movie, doing something insane. And, you know, bikes are this metaphor for being an outlier, for being a bit different, for freedom, being an individual. So it ticks hundreds of boxes. I mean, you've even got Keira Knightley on a Ducati 750 selling sort of Chanel number 5 still on TV as an advert, because bikes are cool. And so really our goal was to create a place for all of that, and which is why we attract so many non-riders, because a lot of people love bikes, but they don't ride, or they're the people in their life that they love who do ride. And so it's a place where everyone can sort of share in that. And the destination, the venue in London, and the same with the place in LA, is probably 50% non-riders most of the time, sometimes more. And our show at Tobacco Dock every year is probably 50% non-riders. And it's also a place where if you do ride, you can bring your family and your friends and your parents and your kids. And I think it's because of all those things, because when you have this sort of level of immersive experience and community, you want to share it and you want to tell other people about it and you want to show them. So we've tried to create space where people can share and show, and also inspire new people to get into it, because biking is otherwise a dying sport. So we need to get young people into it and get young people on two wheels. And finally, that's beginning to happen.
Yeah, that's the thing there that I've taken, that it's a dying sport because people see it as unsafe. And in the UK, and we were talking about it before we came on, like the weather's a big thing. The roads aren't great. And I actually feel, and I will say this, so I used to go on the road bike a lot. And I had a couple of mates who've had really serious accidents on a road bike. So I don't go on a road bike. I feel safer going out on my big bike. You know what I mean? I feel safer in that environment, but the roads just in this country just don't feel like they're set up compared to in France. Like being in America, I was in Colorado as well. My mate rides there, and you can just see that. Like, so that's a big problem as well, isn't it? The fact that there's no investment in this country, in that space.
I think the roads aren't great, but I mean, you can go all over the world and find crap roads. I think a lot of it is, there's two elements, is other drivers' awareness of motorcycles, which actually in the UK is quite high compared to other countries. We do bike safe courses in the bike shed in London. And they say once you get over a certain level of bikes in the population, that car drivers get quite good at looking out for them. So the more there are, the kind of the safer it is in a weird way. But I think a lot of it is riders taming themselves. You know, if you're on Instagram and you're a bike rider, you probably get all these videos of people having crashes on motorcycles. I do. Maybe I should stop looking at them.
That's what it is, yeah. And that and plane crashes. I don't know why. They're married up.
It's scary.
Maybe it's me.
But the thing is, I look at a lot of them, and a lot of them are sort of young people on sports bikes, and they go, oh, who's at fault? Or, you know, car at fault or whatever. And I'm looking at them and thinking, when you ride a motorcycle, especially a sports bike, which has really been designed over the last 20 years, especially by, you know, the sports bike manufacturers, to go as fast as possible from MotoGP prototype technology, you're really building vehicles that aren't that suitable for the road. And it's like driving around in a Ferrari. You know, the network infrastructure in roads in the UK is not made for vehicles like that, that are super fast, that have that level of power to weight ratio, that can do 0-60 in 2 seconds. It's just not a good idea. And I don't think car drivers can ever be prepared for the speed at which a motorcycle suddenly approaches them from behind or in front, and they're hard to see. So I think it's kind of incumbent on us as riders to be critically aware of ourselves and not ride like morons. And the problem is when you're in your 20s and you're fueled with testosterone and you get a fast bike, you want to go faster and faster and faster. And I went through that. I went through years of sports bikes, fast bikes, supermoto bikes, going as fast as I could and coming back from Sunday morning rides, realizing that I was lucky to be alive. And what really changed things was people getting into adventure bikes and then getting into the modern classics. And I think people were already there in the world of Harley Davidsons. I think people identified this idea of cruising. That whole word sums it up. You're enjoying the moment. You're in the moment. And I think, but a lot of people weren't necessarily attracted to that American culture, and they didn't, all the things that kind of you loved about it, quite a few people don't warm to that. They don't go for the Sons of Anarchy, Hell's Angels sort of vibe. But they might go for the kind of the modern classic twin Triumph Royal Enfield type vibe, or they might go for the Charlie Borman big adventure bike. And I think that culturally over the last 10 years has given people permission to slow down. And I'm going to have to say, in sort of 10 years of doing Bike Shed, there are very few people now that I know have really seriously hurt themselves in the UK. A different story in LA. LA's really dangerous.
I was chatting to Stu. I couldn't believe
his first proper accident.
Yeah, that's what he said.
Yeah, in all those years of riding, all those hundreds of thousands of miles. Mm. So I think that one of the things for me is that biking is now safer than it's ever been. Because one, the culture has moved away from the alpha male, how fast can you go, have you got your knee down, do you do track days, into that's a cool bike. And riding these modern classics, the culture's given permission for people to ride slowly and enjoy the moment. And also now you've got better bikes with traction control and sort of ABS and cornering ABS and all these other bits of technology that mean the bikes are safer. And I think the attitude is safer. So in some ways, it's a really golden era of riding. And also a lot of people coming into bikes later in life, they're just more sensible and they don't want to die. I don't want to die on a bike. It's not my plan A. I mean, I'm 58 this year.
Look well for 58.
It's all Photoshop. But it's like, I don't want to die on a bike. I love biking. I ride all the time and I do track days and supermoto days and dirt days. And I don't fall off a lot because, not because I'm a good rider, because I don't ride beyond my abilities. And if people did that on the road a little bit more, we'd all be hearing less stories of people hurting themselves really badly on road bikes on the road. So it's a very long answer to your question. But I think now's actually a good time to be riding because I think the bikes are right and the culture's right and the attitude is right.
What else do you think the issue is then? Why people aren't picking up bikes?
I mean, it is scary, isn't it? I mean, I know a lot of people coming back to bikes now. And it's like, well, my kids are now adults and my wife will let me have a bike. Now, if you love someone and they do something that might kill them, it's perfectly reasonable to wish they didn't do it. And so a lot of people have kind of frozen bikes out of their life for a few years because they had years of responsibility where they were scared of hurting themselves because you're on the outside of a vehicle. And if you do have an impact, there's nothing to protect you. Well, I mean, suit technology is pretty good now. But still, you know, you're in a vulnerable position. And so I think people are reasonably afraid. And I also think we're in a culture where people are afraid of everything. Mm. I think, you know, generally speaking, we're all mollycoddled into the world now, especially people in their 20s. They really don't get out there. It's really polarizing. People are either really athletic and sporty and want to get out and do things. And, you know, they're inspired to jump out of planes and climb and run and do kind of crazy things, or they're just not. And I think there's a lot of sedentary people who are afraid of risk. But I think motorcycling is a measured and calculating risk now. And if you take a test in the UK, you're a skilled person. And the more you ride, the more skilled you get. And you can take more training and become more skilled. And the bikes are technically competent machines and no one's giving you shit if you don't go fast. So I think there's a bit of an education process to say, look, it's all right. Get on a bike and, you know, don't fall off. I mean, people say to me all the time, I don't want to do a track day because I don't want to crash. And I'm like, well, don't crash then. Mm-hmm.
That's the thing. Like, you've nailed it again on all of these points, of course, around the kids. Like, having four children and looking at society now and the kind of offerings and the conversations that are being had, but just how comfortable society is for kids just to sit there flicking on iPads, not going out, consumed in a world. They can ride a bike now without riding a bike. Do you know what I mean? That's the thing. You put your headphones on, you go on YouTube, you do these VR headsets and stuff. So, but I'm with you on these things. Like, I am, risk taker is probably the wrong way of putting it. I'm an outdoorsman. I love being outside. Yeah. And I go back to my experiences of riding and why I like it. The simplicity is what you said is probably the number one thing. I don't think about anything else, and being out in the elements, and there is a risk of, the risk of danger as well. It gives you the feeling of being alive. You know, there's a part of that as well, having played sport at the highest level, you'll never get that again. But I suppose the individuality of being out there as well, and there's not a load of other people, but it's then how you push that through to the kids. If I spoke to my wife, she'd be like, nah, You know, but she understands why I want to and why there's a part of me needing to do that. But this is what I mean, like, as in, there's no pushes there now for kids to get out there.
It's a shame because
on a motorbike.
I think a big part of life is measured risk. You know, whether it's in sort of business or life or even getting married. I mean, we're supposed to take risks. We're
getting
to
married. Hey, 50, 60% risk now.
Well, at the end of the day, you're sort of going, I'm going to spend my life with a person or like making a child. I mean, you know, we evolved through genetics to make that the outcome of something fun for a reason. You know, nobody should, when people say I'm planning kids over, I would chuckle to myself. I was like, really? You're actually planning that? It's like, is it normal? The way it worked in the past was it just happened after a really good time. Because planning it seems like a terrible idea.
One of the things I've found really interesting, and you've mentioned risk a few times, that's an obvious thing when you ride bikes, how you have as well, but was more about your career. And there's a large part of that where I think a lot of people would love to do what you've done and take a risk from a great career, comfortable career, and go down the route of, you know, the COVID thing. Let's do something that you love. Let's open a coffee shop because we like coffee. But you did take a big risk in doing that. Has that paid off? Are you? What advice would you give to people that would want to leave that high-flying job behind and go all in on something which takes a lot of work to build?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've been very fortunate and also quite unfortunate as well. I mean, I think, you know, leaving a proper grown-up job in media, you know, as a married dad with kids and responsibilities and having my wife do the same thing, both of us, you know, doing that at the same time was a huge risk. But I spent my whole life managing other people's brands, you know, working in broadcasting, whether I was responsible for the Cartoon Network team and how they draw Scooby-Doo as the creative director, or being at MTV and how people care about that brand and how it means more to them than it probably does to the current owners. And the opportunity to build a brand for a community from scratch for us was something we couldn't pass up. And I think the one bit of advice I'd say is you have to believe and you have to commit. You have to decide that's what you're going to do. And I think there's an awful lot to be said for the Vikings who used to burn their boats at the beach. You know, the only way they're going home is if they conquer the village, move in, chop down some new trees, build some new boats, and then they can go home. If they lose, they're not going home. And I think you need your plan to be plan A, and your plan B needs to be the same as your plan A. Mm. And you just need to go, this is what I'm going to do, and commit, because it isn't easy. Now, we were fortunate because when we started doing Bike Shed and, you know, 2013 onwards, from the show in 13 to the venue in 2015, was actually a sort of time of where that was quite good for being an entrepreneur. And it was quite easy to raise cash from people with money who were like, you know, there were things like the Enterprise Investment Scheme and there were tax breaks and stuff. And we managed to find a whole bunch of people who had some spare cash and said, well, we're going to do this thing. Do you want to give us some money? You might never see it again, but if it works, it'll be epic. And that was great. And we were doing really, really well. And then Opening LA started that project in 2018 into 19. Also, it was a really easy time to, not easy time, you have to work really hard, but it was a time when people wanted to invest in fun stuff. But from COVID onwards, it has been a shit show. I mean, it was really tough. COVID nearly ended the business. And I wouldn't normally say this, but credit to the UK government for the 80% scheme where they paid people's wages. And we didn't fire a single person. We kept everybody on staff and even looked after the people that weren't part of the furlough scheme. We were able to do that. And also we mobilised the community. We did that whole community response thing during COVID, which was also amazing.
Yeah, just explain what that was, because that was cool.
So, yeah, so basically COVID hit, everything was shutting down, and somebody messaged Vicky and said, oh, my parents are up north and they're both really ill, they're both immunocompromised. And do you know anybody, you've got a big network, do you know anybody up there that could look in on them and see if they're all right? And Vicky was like, yeah, I'm sure we know someone up there. We'll just ask on Facebook. And we found somebody that could go and look in on them. And we were chatting and she said, we've got all these motorcycle riders all over Britain and they could all be checking in on other people. They could all be looking out for other people and helping them out. Because they said, could they do some shopping for them? And we kind of thought, that's a really good idea. So we sort of just chatted about it. And in the nature of our normal way of doing things, I just created a Facebook page and I called it Bike Shed Community Response. And I put out a call on our main page saying, who would volunteer to help their local community using their bikes? Because obviously first responders and couriers use motorcycles for a reason. And who would help? Who would do welfare checks, look in on people, do a bit of shopping, maybe pick up a prescription? And I think in 2 days we had 800 volunteers. And I was like, oh, this is a thing. So then we reached out to see if we could get support. And Indian Motorcycle said they'd support us. And then there was Rubicon, ex-military people. And then there was this app called Gopher, who said they'd build an app for us. And we got all these people kind of helping us out. And we built an app that was basically a courier app to onboard riders to give them a sort of a security check to make sure they weren't a wrong'un and make sure they got a license, make sure they're insured and got a legal bike and got them properly uploaded into this app. And we ended up creating this community of about 1,400 volunteers across the UK and created a network of kind of call handlers. And we ended up doing, I think, 30,000 deliveries through COVID over 22 months. And we were delivering prescriptions as well as PPE, food, medicine, looking after people where young kids were the primary responsible parent in a home. So looking after sort of people that were sort of young and vulnerable. And we just did loads and loads of stuff. And people kept reaching out to us and say, well, can you do this on a motorcycle? And we go, yeah, sure, let's give it a go. And it was brilliant. And it really showed how strong the community is. And people were doing it on all sorts of motorcycles all over the UK. And we ended up trialing the sort of while you wait COVID tests on a motorcycle. So that whole era of when you could get a motorcycle COVID test, we were the ones that checked that out, pioneered that for the NHS. And then the NHS took it over. So it was amazing, an amazing thing to do. And it kept us busy through COVID, stopped us going insane. And I think it really helped us as a brand and a company to really connect with the community very directly.
That's what I was going to say.
Because it wasn't about money. You know, we didn't earn a penny from it. It was all about mobilising humans and getting to do something good for the UK, for Britain.
Yeah, and maybe that's where the support galvanised and gathered coming out of COVID, because the heartbeat of the business, it seems, is hospitality, or not, like food and drink and like a lot of things. I say that because I've involved in a few bars, Wolfpack Lager. We struggled through COVID, really struggled. And a restaurant that I was involved in before, Mac and Wild, a Scottish restaurant. We had a couple of restaurants in London. And as soon as COVID hit, bang, it was just, you know, impossible to keep going. We could have taken the grants and stuff like that, but we kind of foreseen what was happening. But that's that seems to be the hardest thing in the UK to navigate through now. Like I saw a podcast pop up and they were talking about, would you start a business in the UK now? And they were going through like the top ones that you would just never do. Like hospitality would be the number one no-go.
It's on its knees in the UK. It really is.
Which is sad in a way, isn't it? Because not only did we lose staff, was staff because of Brexit or not?
I think mainly, there was a bit of losing staff through Brexit, but less than you'd think.
Yeah, I mean,
it certainly didn't help. And it certainly didn't help with e-commerce, because suddenly selling into Europe became a non-starter. You know, surprise tax bills. You know, somebody buys a T-shirt online and gets a £20 bill when it turns up in their door because of some tax that everyone had forgotten.
That's what I mean. So everything you've kind of pointed towards, hospitality, like merchandise, having to employ staff, it's a big old beast. So I was going to say, like, compared here to the one in LA, which I imagine was a bigger beast, is it easier to navigate?
They're both suffering in similar ways, because I think we're in a post-COVID economic depression that's changed everything. Because
Is that a thing then? So what you've just said?
There are a few things that I would sort of, and I think London and LA are similar enough cities in how they function, especially with big kind of media and creative business driving the economies. There's a huge work from home culture now. Loads and loads of businesses. On Mondays and Fridays, people work from home. And what they call them something funny, the people who don't. They call them twats, don't they? Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday.
Yes.
People who only work Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. So the Friday night drinkings disappeared, and Monday, forget about it. Most restaurants are closed on a Monday now, and bars. And also daytime going out for food has kind of disappeared. So your daytime weekday trade in London and LA has fallen off a cliff. And then people are, and I think also during COVID, people really got used to this whole sort of Uber Eats, DoorDash culture of ordering food online. And it really polarized food because it's either, you know, nice food in your living room while you watch Netflix, because also we had a whole culture of watching movies with Netflix and Amazon and Disney, and, you know, we're suddenly all couch potatoes who order food in, who don't go to work on Mondays and Fridays. That's a massive cultural change. I mean, I think it's reflected in how unhealthy people are now as well, and how unsociable they are. I think, you know, we've really lost the ability to get out there and talk to people, and also we've really spending two more days a week being sedentary than we should. But it's really affected hospitality and retail, and also retail, because everybody started buying things online. If I want a pair of socks now, I go on Amazon. I don't go to Marks and Spencer's, you know, anymore, or wherever I used to go. So for me, everything's completely different. So if you're in retail or hospitality or events, it's really, really hard, and it's really polarized. And we're in all three of those businesses. It's hard to get people to come out. And then on top of that, everyone's earning less money and everything costs more. And specifically in retail and hospitality, the costs are 30, 40% up to where they were pre-COVID. And you can't pass that on to the customer. And we still get reviews that go, you know, £14.50 for a full English breakfast. And it's like, well, yeah, of course it costs a bit less than that to make it at home. But at the end of the day, we're running a huge venue in central London, and up the road it's £16.50. And we haven't passed all of the increased prices onto the customers.
It's really interesting. I've just come back from Japan and I've heard amazing things about Japan, about the culture, about the service, about the food. And because now what I've come accustomed to, or we've come accustomed to in the UK, where service in most places, frankly, is beyond shockingly bad. You know, like a lot of the people, and I know this from, again, my experiences and people working in that industry, have got no idea about what they're serving up. They can't even have eye contact with you when they're pouring a pint. They don't know what wine they're serving you. I had a glass of wine in Edinburgh at the week. I said, oh, where's the wine from? No idea.
Yeah.
So, you know, 13 quid for a glass of wine. Yeah. And he was like, oh, I don't know, China. I said, let's have it. It was chilly. He thought it was China.
Yeah.
And again, I'm having a moan here, but because I'm looking at someone like you who's built a really great brand, which a lot of people would want to do. I'd love to do something like that. Like, I look at it and I mentioned to you, I said, why don't we do one of these up in Scotland? People don't go out, maybe on a Friday.
Yeah.
It's gone. You know, that industry is gone, because if the heartbeat of it is hospitality, serving food, coffees, beers, you know, even getting to a venue now, it's kind of, you know, like we can't drink and drive, so taxis have gone through the roof. Like, it's everything. I'm being very negative on this, but being in Japan, I was like, maybe it's the language. I don't know what it is, but they just had it right.
Well, like, they have pride. And they have a few things, don't they? They have duty. What's that? Giri. And then they also have another thing, which is like purpose. And I can't remember the word for that. But they've always got these good Japanese words for, like, if you're going to do a thing, do it properly.
Exactly that.
And kaizen, constant improvement, which we try and have at Bikeshed. That idea of always trying, like, what can be better today than from yesterday? What can you do incrementally? And I think it's just, Vicky was just out in Japan for 2 weeks as well, and she came back going, oh my God.
Really?
The world is fucked.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Japan's amazing and everything else is shit.
Yeah.
You know, why does everything work there and it doesn't work here?
Interesting.
Because it was service, it was public transport, it was even the road network and signage.
Millions.
She said, I'm in Japan and I'm finding it easier to get around the whole of Japan than I do in London or LA and follow signs and or ask directions or get on the right train. It's just
exactly
it's crazy, just and crazy. But I think we've lost pride. I mean, one of the things, I mean, I was asked, I've done a few podcasts and somebody asked me about my career and how I got into broadcasting and TV, because I was TV director, producer for years. I worked as a runner in a editing production company in Soho called Ravensdale. And I was basically the tea boy. I made tea and coffee. And so I don't even know how old I was, 21, 22. And people would come in and I'd remember how they had their coffee and their tea. And I did a really good job. And I remembered what food and breakfast they liked. And I used to pop out and get their food and I'd fill the fridge. And I did that for a year or so. I think I earned $7,000 a year for that, for the privilege of that job. And then my boss, Sarah, got poached by MTV, who was one of our clients, to go and be their head of production. And she just said, you're coming with me. because you do a really good job of making the tea and the coffee, and you're diligent, you give a shit about what you do. And I need someone to come and work with me who I trust and I know to just get stuff done. So come and work with me. And it was because I was good at making the tea and remembering what people's food orders were.
Yeah, but this is, and, I mean, you'll know this now.
Yeah, people have lost that pride because, you know, you see these kind of hilarious things pop up on social media of people sort of moaning about, you know, they've got a university degree and they don't want to work in a supermarket. Well, of course they don't want to work in a supermarket. I mean, I stacked shelves. I worked on building sites doing drywall. I don't want to sound like an old man. You know, I did stacking shelves at supermarkets and making all the labels face the front in the middle of the night. And I worked in a place stirring face cream and putting oats into face scrub. Mm. You know, you pay your dues.
Exactly.
And but you take pride in that. You go, well, I'm going to do a good job. If whatever job I'm doing, you may as well do a good job and enjoy it. And I think the problem now is people don't give a shit. And we talk a lot at Bike Shed about the give a shit-o-meter. Why would anybody care? If we're going to do anything, why would someone else care about the fact that we do it, and who's going to care enough to do it well? So I think those things are being lost because people are just entitled now. They just have this sense of privilege. And I think it's great we live in a country where everyone gets a university education, but what's it for? Mm. I mean, my daughter, she's got a degree in psychology, and it's not easy getting a job. You know, she's a degree educated, incredibly smart young woman. And, you know, she's working in a sustainability store, which is great because she's really into that. And she's going for some, you know, jobs in sort of corporate sustainability and things. But it's really hard because everyone's got a degree.
I was chatting with my wife about it when we talk about education for the kids and the state of schools and English, math, science, and it being very rigid. And we were just, it was off the back of Japan and some of the kind of cool bars that we went into, but it was the level of service and kind of understanding, listening to the people behind the bar. One of the guys was clearly Japanese, speaking English to me. He was speaking Spanish to another customer. Wow. I was like, this fucking bloke works behind the bar. And I agree. I worked behind a bar for years and had these mundane jobs. I was a painter and decorator. I was a labourer on a building site for years. I was stat data inputter for Wimbledon and the tennis tour where they wanted to get it from manuals onto database computers. Like very mundane jobs. But me and the wife were talking, like, if you're spending education on the kids and you're investing in your kids' future, one, what does that mean? I won't answer it now. And we were just talking about the want for kids. So I came back from Japan and I was like, I won't ever tell the kids that. I'll let them do what they want to do, whether they want to play sport, or my daughter sings and draws and she's creative, like artistic and that. I said, I want them to go and travel. I'd love them to work behind bars. And my wife's like, "What? Why bars?" I said, because I think that kind of job in the hospitality teaches you hard work. It teaches you how to be sociable. And you do it in a way in which it isn't done now. So you look at someone in the eye when you're talking to them. You understand everything that you're delivering them from the food. You know, that personal service. I said, these life skills, I said, are gone now. Yeah. And I said, if you can work behind a bar and you can engage with the customer, you understand the value of money, you know, transaction of these things, you know, where the things are made. Like, you understand that a glass cost £1.20, so you don't want to break it, because if you break 1,000 of them glasses, like throughout a year or whatever, that has a monetary value for the business. Just small things along the way. So it wasn't about the kids working in a bar. It was like the understanding that a job like that in hospitality can give you such life skills if it's done properly.
Well, that's what's missing from education, is life skills. Because you end up with all these kids that are super well-educated, and all the schools are on these performance systems, you know, where they've got graphs and charts for how many, you know, how many A's or 8s or whatever it is these days that kids get. And they don't learn life skills. And both my daughters, in fact, Saskia still works at Bike Shed as a waitress. She's 18. And it transformed both of them personality-wise, because all of a sudden, I remember as a kid, you know, when I was, you know, 15, 16, 17, adults don't exist. You talk about them like they're not there. Mm-hmm. You laugh at the bald man in front of you on the bus thinking he can't hear you. But it, going out there and having to interact with people not of your generation or of your ilk, and talking to them and being empathic and finding out what they want and making suggestions and, like you say, looking them in the eye and reading a room and seeing who needs to be served or looked after or an upsell to help make the business more money. Mm-hmm. Those are really powerful life skills. And also learning service and understanding the relationship between, you know, you and your customer and the kitchen and you know, having that sort of sense of being in a team. Those things are really powerful. And I saw the effect they had on both my kids because it made them more confident and more sociable and more able to talk to anyone. And I would absolutely recommend it as a must do for all kids to do some sort of job like that in retail or hospitality where you have to serve people. I mean, service is an underrated word. Mm. And I think, you know, a lot of being part of humanity, because we're these sociable animals that don't really work on our own. We only work because we're part of society. Is service to society is really powerful. It's really important. A bit more important than entitlement, to be honest. And I think being in a service industry teaches you service. So I think everybody should have a go at that.
Yeah, I think there's a shift now as well. And maybe people in our industry who are forging their own path, and I suppose, can financially afford it. I would prefer to go and pay £4.10 or £4.50 for a flat white that's been made properly as opposed to £3 for one that's just been plopped on the table like that. And there you go. Like there's zero service. And I think there's an appetite now. More and more people want that. So if they go out, if they buy something, if they go and have a look at clothes and there is that kind of shift, they want that experience. I genuinely believe that. And it's like you go back. Like if the experience is great,
there's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
You'll tell your mates, and you know, I'm talking about Japan, and I could give a load of recommendations. Like, if you go to Tokyo, go to this, but it was phenomenal.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that more and more places, we need them, but we don't have them. And I go back to the bike shed every time. I know we're talking up here, of course. I'm not just saying that, but every time I've been in, like, everything has been on point. And that must be so difficult to manage with staff, you know, trying to get the right people in. Because you need mass, you need bodies, don't you?
Yeah, that's you do.
That's part of it as well.
Yeah, it's like a high turnover in that industry.
That's what I'm saying. Mm. Is there a high... We've got a high turnover at the bars.
Normally there is. I mean, we've amazingly retained a huge amount of our staff, and staff come back as well, which is really fantastic. I mean, one of my favourite things is every time we have our New Year's Eve party, staff come back. Staff I haven't seen for 3-4 years who worked at the bike shed come back because we're where they want to have New Year's Eve, which is crazy. You know, they get on the dance floor and you know, Anna, who works in our retail, who's now a DJ, always comes back and DJs New Year's Eve. And it's such an amazing crowd of cool, young, crazy, funky humans. And we've had, you know, some of our managers have been with us since the day we opened, and that's not normal either. I think a lot of it is they're in something that they can see is different. People are there as part of a community. A lot of people come 3 or 4 times a week. I mean, we have a membership at the bike shed. There's a club membership attached, which obviously you don't have to join, but for the people who ride, they can. It's about 300 members. And on any given day, there's 5 members in the venue. So they're going to notice if the coffee's a bit off or the breakfast starts to shrink in portion size or the food's not as nice or it arrives cold. And I think they feel that idea. And you know, one of the things that I really love about the vibe we have is I remember Charlie Borman came and did a talk because he's one of our crew, one of our members and one of our backers as well. And he came and did a talk and one of our members was there And this is a guy who makes loads of money and he's got really nice adventure bikes and you know, wants to sort of go touring around the world. And he was sitting there next to one of our guys who's a kitchen porter in our kitchen, who also has an adventure bike and rides. And they're both there hanging on Charlie's every word, side by side, kitchen porter and member, you know, opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of the service relationship. You know, one guy's cooking the other guy's food. But they're both united by this common ground of wanting to go on an adventure on their adventure bikes. And I think we do have that idea that, you know, when you come to Bike Shed, everyone's in that community and the person serving you might ride bikes and they might be, you know, they're part of the community that they're in and they'll stay after work and they'll have drinks. And which is almost a bit of a problem sometimes because all the staff hang around and they're all, you know, hanging out and drinking at the bar after. Especially in the US, which is great. It's a great compliment. But you don't want your venue just to be populated by your staff. Always a good vibe. So I think that's part of it. You create a vibe. And I think, you know, we're quite good at being present. We're present owners. You know, although we travel between the US and the UK all the time, if I'm in LA, I'm in the Bike Shed. And if I'm in London, I'm in the Bike Shed. And people see that. So I think that makes a difference. And we're happy to pick up boxes and move things around. And, you know, Vicky's always getting behind the bar and cleaning glasses and probably just getting in everyone's way. But, you know, if we're stacked, if we're slammed, she's there clearing tables and people can see that.
Yeah. What's the LA one like then in comparison? You've obviously got the weather, you've got the bigger roads. But I imagine that's tough to get anything off the ground in LA. I just presume it's a lot bigger, better, more expensive, tougher.
Yeah, all of the above. I mean, LA is bigger. I mean, the London venue is about 12,000 square feet of space and LA is on a 30,000 square foot plot with a big parking lot. And it's a big 1945 industrial warehouse. It's all at loading bay height. And the whole thing's raised off the ground and it's big, giant, industrial, old school American bricks and wooden vaulted ceilings, really high ceilings. And it's this giant warehouse populated by a club on the inside with a big brass island bar and Chesterfield sofas. And it's pretty awesome. So a fantastic place. We've got a little secret speakeasy out the back that looks like an English gentleman's club from the 1930s. It's a very, very cool venue. But LA is incredibly expensive. It's also a real nanny state bureaucratic culture with a lot of rules and regulations and compliance.
What does nanny state mean?
Well, where you're literally, everyone's holding your hand and telling you what you can and can't do. You know, it's that whole kind of 20 mile an hour speed limit vibe and cycle lanes everywhere, even if nobody uses them. Don't get me started. But that whole idea, it's a place where it's all about compliance, you know, like how wide is your door and have you got enough wheelchair ramps and things, which is great, but they do take it to the ultimate level. And so it's also a place where insurance is really expensive and someone's always trying to sue you for something. So actually, in hindsight, I wouldn't have started in LA. I'd have started in Texas. LA is amazing for the roads, the people, the culture, the vibe. It's biking nirvana. It really is. And also, I like LA people, despite what everyone says. They're not shallow. They're actually, there's a really good crowd of people that live in and around LA. And it's a really big state with a lot of different vibes. You can always find your people somewhere. They'll be there. And I've been really pleasantly surprised by the warm welcome we've got and the community that we've attracted. But it's a very hard place to do business. Basically, anything you do, anything you want to do, just treble the cost. And literally, just treble it. I mean, you know, and the cost of staff, the cost of people, the minimum salary out there for a full-time person is $65,000 a year. If you want somebody on non-hours, if you want them to be full-time, it's a minimum. And I think the minimum wage there's now $22 an hour, so it's incredibly expensive and they keep pushing those up. So what it means is everybody's businesses cost them more to run, so they then put their prices up, which means everybody needs to earn more, so they're just creating constant inflation. So your staff earn more but going out costs them more.
Yeah,
so they need to earn more. Brilliant. So they've really messed up. The microeconomy in LA is a disaster. And that's why loads of companies are leaving LA and moving to
Texas and Colorado. Yeah,
Colorado and Georgia, especially Texas and Georgia, because they have a really similar cultural vibe in the big cities there. But they don't have the nanny state crap that goes with it.
See, I've heard that around America from different podcasts that I've listened to and some mates. I love America. I'm a massive fan. And I guess some people just think guns, they think Trump, they think like chaos. I've never experienced anything like that. Well, I've been to Colorado. I've been loads of places in America, but it's a place I could definitely move to. Like, I love Texas, the sun. Yeah. I can't stop thinking about it. Every day, waking up in Edinburgh and it's pissing it down, I'm like, Texas.
It's hard to get away from weather. I think the other thing about America is America's a lot more like Europe than it is like England. I mean, it's the United States, and every state is different. And once you get your head around the idea that there's this federation of states that operate under federal law, but then each state has its own state law. And, you know, and if you like guns, you can't go there, but you can go there. You just cross a border. And same with strip clubs. If you like boobs, you can't see boobs there, but you can go see boobs there.
Where?
So it's kind of, you know, you just find the state or the town that suits you and you go live there. You know, if you want to be, you know, super healthy, octogenarian, vegan, there's a place called Yorba Linda in California. Go live there. You know, that's fine. You'll find your vibe. And, you know, if you want to just shoot guns, just move to Orange County. It's literally, there's a place for you somewhere. And even that's just in California, never mind the rest of America.
The London-LA link, is that a lot to do with the people involved with the bike shed as well? Because I know there's a bit of glitz and glamour. There's some celebs involved, isn't there?
I think the media
that's the
bit.
That's the media bit.
Yeah, the media sort of creative people and a bit of celebrity, a bit of Hollywood celebs.
Who's involved? Are we allowed to share?
I think I know a couple. But I have to always remember who doesn't mind me saying something. Tom Hardy is one of our backers. He's a great guy.
He's not in LA, he's in Richmond though, isn't he?
He's in Richmond, sort of. Actually, he's got another place, but I can't say where it is. So Tom's a great guy, and he's been an amazing supporter. Woody Harrelson, through Tom.
Really?
Yeah.
I've just finished watching True Detective.
I went and saw his play that he did at the theatre. Oh, I can't remember what the theatre's called now. It's like a three-hander. Anyway, you can't see it anymore, so forget about it. But he's just amazing on stage. Oh, my God. What a man. What a character. And really fun to hang out with. Smokes a lot, drinks a lot.
Oh, he does. So have you seen True Detective?
I haven't seen True Detective, no. But he's got a place called The Woods in LA, which is basically a smoke shop. He's always... No, I can't say it. He smokes a lot.
How old is he now, roughly?
I don't even know. I don't think he's really old. I think he's late 50s. So there's Tom and there's Woody. Nicholas Holt, he rides bikes. He's a great guy. Pom Clementiff, who's a really good friend of Vicky's and Nicholas's. She was the baddie in the Mission Impossible, the last one.
Yes.
So Pom's amazing. Really, really cool and become a good friend. Nick Mason from Pink Floyd, the drummer. He's one of our backers.
Keep going. I'm loving this.
Yeah.
I know a few because I did a bit of research into it and was just looking, but keep going.
Yeah. I mean, there's a few that are sort of interesting people, you know, who are just amazing at what they do, you know. And two of our early backers, there's an amazing guy called Frederick Lukoff, who was the president and CEO of Stella McCartney. And he's got more motorcycles than you've ever seen. And then he worked for Scotch and Soda as the CEO, and now he's at this new young brand called Casablanca. And then Nicholas Cowell, Simon Cowell's brother, who's a big real estate guy. And, you know, Nicholas and Frederick were two of our earliest backers who were prepared to put their own money into it. And again, Nicholas is a huge bike rider, does big adventures all over the place. Super, super nice guy. Charlie Borman, obviously. It's a really nice crowd. But we've actually got 99 backers, 99 investors. And all of them are interesting. All of them are somebody who's done something.
I imagine part of it is as well, and you might get this from me, like being in a team environment, being a kind of creative, if you want to call it that, so the mind spinning all the time, that it's actually, it feels like being a part of something for these people. So it isn't just the financial, oh, here you go. And it will be for some people when they invest, obviously, but it's for them to be part of a community, to say, oh, I'm part of the bike shed. Oh, that's cool. We've got one in London. We've got one in LA.
I think none of them did it for the money. I mean, I think most people, when they gave us their money for London, thought they'd never see it again. And I think even for LA, it was a big risk. I mean, the reason we've got 99 investors is because people didn't say, here's 5 million quid. They went, oh, I've got 50 grand. So that's a much easier conversation. And at certain points, you know, there were times, when, you know, especially through COVID and soon after, where we thought everyone was just going to lose all their money. I mean, there have been loads of times where we could have gone out of business and nearly did and had to raise a bit more money. But everyone believed in it, so they kept backing it. But I don't think anybody's really done it for the money. There were maybe one or two investors that were kind of like family offices where they thought, oh, this could be worth a few quid. But, you know, right now they haven't realised their investment just yet because, you know, they're going to have to wait because we're still growing. We're not paying anybody dividends. Nobody's making money out of this. They've bought into something. They're growing a brand. They've created some IP. And, you know, and our mission is to create this global company. We want to preserve motorcycle culture. And I want a bike shed in every city in the world that wants one. Unfortunately, it's a really difficult time to raise the kind of capital to do that. So we've created the model. We know how it works. And we're probably going to do some franchises. So there'll be some announcements on that soon. But really what we want to do is be owner operators and we want to create bike sheds everywhere. So, we're not done yet.
Yeah. But part of that, we were talking about podcasting, and everyone's got a podcast now, and I'm lucky because I've been in the industry for 8 years, like doing this or whatever, so it's great to be able to talk about an industry which I know a little bit about. But everyone talks about doing a podcast because it's kind of central to the brand. You're instantaneously social media, you're out to your audience or your fans or people that are interested in the brand. But like we were talking about before, I think because of the bike shed and the people involved, it's not just the name, it's the stories that they'll have by riding a bike. So the stuff that people are interested in, the culture aspect of it, the travel aspect. Like if you were to put like the top of the list of interest in podcast genres, you know, music would be near the top. Travel would probably be at the top. Adventure would be another one. Risky things like riding bikes, rock climbing, skydiving. You know what I mean? You bring in an audience that wants that. And I feel like the motorbike industry is underserviced in that. And I think with the bike shed and the names that you've got, like Ewan McGregor, you look at the stuff of traveling around the world and the kind of South America trip. Even if you're not into bikes, well, one, it's him, right? So it's a big name. But people are interested in these crazy places. I listened to a podcast. I don't even know who it was. It was a poorly done podcast, and it was done during COVID remote. And it was about a guy who'd ridden his BMW across Russia and India. And he's talking about it. And I was like, and they were just going, like, jumping question to question. So, I mean, it's the fucking craziest thing I've ever heard. Like, you're riding a motorbike across Russia in snow, all the issues they've got there, like it's dangerous, like you're in India. This is mental. And I think that there's more people that want to know more about that. Like, I think you can get into people's lives and be like, this is mental.
Yeah, I mean, I feel a bit guilty in some ways that we haven't done a podcast because I keep doing
You have a responsibility
things.
Is what I'm saying.
Yeah,
because of your industry, yeah. Dutch, that's why. Because you've worked in media, because of the people that you know. I know that you've kind of dabbled in that. But even the stuff that we're talking about here that you could go further into, living in LA, building a business, hospitality, you know, the people that are working in there, the lives of the famous people, the people that aren't, the pot washer that rides, like why does he ride? You know, and this is the interest that I have because military, like I mentioned, is a big thing. Because
loads of military people.
Because it gives a man, and I use that kind of specific word, it gives like these people that sense of belonging, a sense of community. Why do you ride? Where have you been? What does it do for you? The mental health aspect of it, the physical, the mental, being outdoor, all these touch points that everyone is yearning towards, me included.
You've talked me into it. No, yeah. We have to do it. I mean, we did a few as kind of, we did the startup story and I think we did one follow on one. And I guess what it is because I worked in TV for a really long time, when I got into biking, I sort of rejected all bike business. I rejected all of that past. And also I was kind of annoyed by the dumbing down of broadcasting. You know, the most popular TV shows were things like Gogglebox and 24 Hours in A&E. Like, imagine watching people watching TV. Wow. I mean, it's actually quite an interesting program, but
I understand what
people,
you mean.
But I was a bit annoyed by the whole ruining of storytelling. And I guess when I sort of started to understand the podcast culture, because I wasn't really somebody that listened to them, is that I really wanted them to be visual as well. And most podcasts these days have got cameras. And then I wanted it to be at Bike Shed because I wanted people to see the vibe. I didn't want it to be in a studio. And the thing is, you do need these controlled environments. I mean, I actually love doing a podcast with headphones on and a microphone because you communicate better when you hear yourself quite loud. You wait, you usually allow people to finish a question. You tend to not interrupt so much and you have your words are more measured. You think more carefully when you hear yourself amplified back. So I think there's a layer of power to the power of just sound and being so in the moment. But I'm a visual person and I want the visual medium. And every time I kind of looked into setting it up, it was like, well, you need a room and you need a space and it needs to be soundproof and you've got to make it look nice. And then you've got to have cameras and a mixing desk. And I just kind of got put off organizing the whole thing, but I'm wasting all these conversations because I have amazing conversations with people like this one. And, you know, I get inspired by the conversation. I was really fortunate and I'm going to do a massive name drop, but Pom Clementif brought Tom Cruise to lunch at the Bike Shed, or dinner, I can't remember. And we just sat at a dinner table outside in the driveway in the Bike Shed in London and had dinner for a couple of hours. And we talked about bikes. Tom Cruise is an amazing guy. And we just talked about motorcycles and he wanted to know all about Bike Shed and why we did what we did and how it all happened. And we ended up talking about him building a motorcycle in his basement of his neighbor's house because his mum didn't want him to ride. And then when he first rode it, the throttle got stuck open and he crashed into his neighbor's car and he gashed his leg open and had to fix it with gaffer tape and a proper Tom Cruise story. And I was like, afterwards, I thought, everyone would want to hear that story. Who wouldn't want to know
that? And he wants to tell that story.
He does. And so many people ride. I mean, I know, you know, people like, you know, Nicholas Holt and Tom Hardy would love to talk about riding. Obviously, you and people I know and I've had conversations with about bikes over a beer or a meal. It's like, why wouldn't that be a podcast? And also, I think a lot of those people, because celebrities are known for being famous and being in a film. I mean, Tom Hardy calls himself a face puller. He's very sort of self-deprecating guy. He doesn't really rate his art sometimes. So even though he's a hero to a lot of people, his heroes are military people. Mm. That's who he looks up to. But him as a bike rider is a very authentic part of who he is. He loves riding bikes. And so I'm sure he'd rather talk about bikes than being in a film.
100%.
You know.
And that's the hook with
and,
these
people. Yeah, and it's also something you can relate to because if you're a huge fan of a Tom Hardy or a Tom Cruise and you think they're amazing and they're like gods that walk among us, as soon as you talk about biking and if you ride or like bikes, they're just like you, you know, and that is a real, it levels the playing field. It's one of the things I love about Bike Shed as a destination, because it doesn't matter who you are, whether you're an A-list celebrity or a CEO or you're a pot washer, do you ride and where have you been? I mean, we're not snobby about people who don't, but if you do, it completely levels the playing field.
The innovation in the space of bike is something that I'm quite interested in. So I was, again, coming out of COVID thinking the direction of career. I was thinking, what would be the dream one? So I was thinking to do something with Harley, like a cool brand where there's a travel lifestyle adventure, but there's a heartbeat of what it is. And like Harley Davidson, I'm a little bit old school with that. But I went further into it and had a look. And I was like, what's their strategy now? So if no one's riding bikes or not as many people are riding bikes now, and you've got this association with Harley and the Hells Angels and gangsters and smoking and drinking and fighting, and yeah, the old folklore is that people are interested in the stories, but you don't see people knocking about on Harleys. So where's the money in that? And it was interesting because the CEO, who is a South African guy, I was looking at what they were doing and they were talking about electrification of bikes. I thought, well, if you're struggling to grow a community already and your core community of Harley riders are probably tattoos, leather jackets, beards, you know what I mean, like profiling them, and you're saying, actually, we're not going to build any more petrol bikes, we're going to build electric bikes. And I think they had an issue with working out the direction of that.
They've had loads of issues, and you can watch it from the sidelines and kind of put your head in your hands. I mean, the thing about Harley Davidson is they've got this incredible legacy and culture, and it was a family business. And it's like a lot of brands that if you don't evolve, you can die. I mean, I work for a lot of TV companies, and one of the big things for me was evolution. I remember turning up to work for Bravo TV as the creative director.
Bravo. Bravo.
Yeah, and they were like, we're in a bit of a mess here because we're part of a portfolio of channels. There was Bravo and Trouble and Challenge and all these other TV stations owned by the same company. We're all fighting over, you know, Will Smith, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air and Knight Rider to put it on our channels because that's what the ratings are. And we don't know who we are. And I was like, well, because when you started in Bravo, you were in the era of Loaded magazine and unapologetically male and burping and drinking beer and thinking it was funny and thinking farts were funny. And you've missed Arena Hom ponytail man doing yoga, and you've missed Daniel Craig, James Bond opening the door for people and being a gentleman again, but being a bit rugged around the edges, but still treating his ladies nice. And you haven't evolved. And if you don't evolve, you end up suddenly having an identity crisis. You've got to keep moving forward. And I think Harley just never evolved. And when and you end up having revolutions instead of evolutions, and revolutions are by nature bloody. You know, somebody has to die and it has to go horribly wrong. And they just didn't move. They tried with Livewire to create first a bike, which Charlie and Ewan rode famously.
That's right. And that's what it was called. And it was called a Harley Livewire.
Yeah,
then they dropped the Harley part.
Well, yeah, what they did was they realised, I think there were quite a few things going on. The bikes were too expensive and people and Harley riders didn't want to buy them. So they created a new company called Livewire to divest themselves of their Harley heritage. And they thought, well, let's just focus on the high-tech California EV market and create something good. And they created a really good bike, actually. Out of all the EVs, it's one of the few I might want to ride. And they created this separate company called Livewire. And then new bosses came in and said, why have we ditched our Harley heritage? Let's bring it back. And now they're putting Harley Davidson on the bikes again. And they've created a second bike called the Del Mar. And there's two versions of that. And it's a really good bike. So they've got three really good, interesting electric bikes. But the problem is the heartland Harley riders don't want them. And they were able to drop the price by changing company without losing face. I think they dropped about 10 grand off the retail price. But I think they're still struggling with an identity crisis. And meanwhile, they're carrying on as Harley, doing what Harley do. And basically having an arms race with Indian Motorcycles to produce legitimate framed V-twin perfect motorcycles. And they're just not evolving fast enough. And it's a real pity. It's a real shame because you see other brands evolving really well. And you see brands like, you know, Royal Enfield or Triumph doing amazing things and going from strength to strength. And you see other brands coming back like BSA and Norton. And you see the Japanese manufacturers moving into that kind of classic resto lifestyle, resto mod culture. And Harley just haven't really quite nailed it. And I think not embracing change at a sort of steady pace is their problem. And I think the other thing is that whole Hell's Angels, Sons of Anarchy culture has, whilst it's kind of romantic and fun for a lot of people, for a lot of other people, it really puts people off. And I think, you know, when I was in my 20s and I was a bike rider, I mean, I grew up in Sussex and we had a couple of bike clubs. There were the Viking Nomads and I can't remember the other ones. There were a whole bunch of nasty bikers who used to turn up at the pub occasionally and smash things up, and I didn't think it was cool. I thought they were assholes. And when you know a bit more about that, and I got closer to that culture as Bike Shed, because obviously you do and you get to know some of these clubs. I mean, they're called outlaws for a reason, and they declare themselves as one percenters for a reason. And the fact that they give you permission to be called an MC is there for a reason, and it's enforced by violence. And so it's kind of romantic and cool to watch on TV and look at Sons of Anarchy or the Mayans or read Hunter S. Thompson and read about the Hell's Angels. But the reality of the culture is a whole bunch of people that enforce their will through violence and intimidation. And it's not fun. It's actually not fun. And so while it looks good from a distance, up close, it doesn't look so good. And I think it's actually done biking a massive disservice for a really long time, because that's what people associate it with. And I think one of the things we did at Bike Shed is we gave people permission to turn up on their motorcycle and to ride a big Harley and not have cut off sleeves leather jacket with skulls and flames on the back, and not act like they're in a gang. Because a lot of people love the fact that they don't have to turn up the alpha male to full chat every time they get on a bike. Because, you know, whilst I really do celebrate and embrace my maleness. I don't mind being a bloke. And you know, and I've certainly had my times in life of being an alpha male twat. But sometimes you need to know when to turn it off and not be a wanker. and those guys don't have an off switch.
Well, that's the shift in society now, isn't it? When you talk about evolving, whether or not you're building a business, whether you're riding bikes, whether you're playing sport, whether you're a father, is how you build something that's cool, that's innovative, that is in with the times, that you can't be that now. And when I ride my Harley, and the only reason I have that, well, I like Harley as a brand. I'd be wrong to say that I don't. And I love the fact they've gone down more of a lifestyle route, like with the likes of Post Malone and the stuff that Jason's done with them and some of the footage that they've done. I like the musical integration. I know that's always been a part of it, but they've kind of gone in like that. But I would ride a Triumph, for example. I would ride, what is it, the BMWs, is it R9s, am I right in saying? The smaller ones, the more...
Yeah, there's the
R90. The R90, is that the smaller one that looks cool?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm too big for that, though. I'm too big to get these bikes.
That scale's a problem. If you're a big bloke, it's hard to find bikes you can ride.
That's what I mean. So I would choose something different, like something a little bit more subtle where I'm not rolling down the street. Like I used to have an open helmet I've still got, but I find it quite embarrassing. You know what I mean? If I'm knocking through the streets of Edinburgh and it's like, you know, it's just, I don't want that. Like, that's not why I'm riding the bike, but I can't find anything that I'm suited to. I'm 6'9".
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
so any recommendations you can give me?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are some big bikes out there that do sort of work. And, I mean, 6'9" is pretty huge.
That's a tall man. There's not many.
Yeah, I mean, and for me, if I was 6'9", I'd be riding adventure bikes all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, I would almost certainly have the new Ducati Desert X because it's just awesome, so cool, channeling sort of design, 80s design vibes from Dakar. But if you like that sort of cruiser culture, I think some of the Indian motorcycles are really cool. Mm. Some of the new 101 looks epic. Check out the new 101 that they've just launched, and also the Challenger. Some really nice bikes out there. I quite like a Harley. I like the low rider. If I was a Harley rider, I'd be a low rider S rider. Mm. I mean, I think they're pretty cool. But there were some bigger Triumphs. The Rocket is awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
Triumph Rocket's a huge bike. Mm. I don't know if it's huge enough.
Anything's going to look small. It's just that doesn't like with the R90. I'm right in saying. So
yeah,
my mate's
got
one, and he's quite tall. He's 6'3".
Yeah, they're not a small bike.
But I've been on it, and even I'm size 14-15 feet. Yeah. You know, so even just trying to change gear and stuff like
that. The R18 is huge.
Yes, I've been on the R18. I like that, but it's more like that. I want it to look a little bit softer. You know, it looked very adventurous, and that's the thing. And if I'm...
Have you tried the Ducati Diavel? The bigger one. I mean, that's a beast of a bike.
Mm. I want it to be more kind of street.
Yeah.
Like that kind of feel. I've done a bit of adventure biking poorly up in the Highlands. That's
a
skill.
Yeah, adventure biking is a skill. Mm. It's brilliant. I mean, once you get into it, it's hard not to get excited by it. Because, I mean, the key word there is adventure, isn't it?
Yeah. And that you don't realise how heavy the bikes are as well. Like once you're on them for a day, you become quite comfortable. And we were riding. I've put my foot out. So normally you're meant to jump off. I've tried to save the bike, and I'm 18 stone, still fairly strongish. And I put my leg, literally snapped my leg when I put it. I thought, why have I done that? Why don't I just jump off?
What was the bike you were on?
It was a Harley, actually. What are the off-road ones called?
I've got collective amnesia now, you've questioned that.
But we were riding the BMW adventure ones as well.
Yeah, yeah. I've completely forgotten the name now, because you can't remember it, I can't remember
it. I'm going to find it.
That's how it works. I mean, those Harley adventure bikes are big, heavy things. I would say, the thing is, adventure bikes can be really tall and really big, but not be heavy. So you can have like a Tenere 700, but I think the sweet spot, especially if I was tall, would be the desert.
Pan America.
Oh, the Pan America. Thank you for that.
There you go.
I'd say that the big Ducati is a really good bike because it's not heavy.
Yeah.
And I rode one to the top of Mount Aspen, and I'm 5'9" and 75 kilos. And I'm not an experienced adventure bike rider. So if I could do that, anyone can.
Mount Aspen in Aspen.
Yeah.
There you go. Well, I was going to talk about that. So I was in Aspen in the summer, and I might have mentioned it to you before. I mentioned it at the start of the show, actually. So my mate Chip, who's the sheriff of Aspen, he's a rider. So he rides Harleys. He has one in the police station, stuff like that. He texted me yesterday before, and I was obviously excited for this. And he's like, oh, when you're in Aspen in July, can you speak to Beck, my wife, we're going to do a ride out over the Rockies. We're going to go from Aspen and do a couple of passes and go down to Denver and watch Neil Young. Wow. Would you be allowed? And I was like, mate, that's, I dream of them things, like as in what makes me happy. Like you saying that, this is like a dream come true. So I said to the wife, she was like, yeah, of course you can. So he's like, and I said, what kind of bikes? And he said, going to look at a couple of Indians because they're bigger bikes to go on. So
I'd try a Challenger.
Okay.
The Challenger's really good. If you want sort of a big open road bike with a proper fairing on it, but they're kind of cool. They're not, it's not the giant sort of road glidey massive thing. And the engines are really good. But I mean, in fact, I'm going to say something slightly different now. Try every bike. Because you've got a good excuse. Go and try a few things. Yeah. The Challenger's a good choice.
I've not been, I mean, I don't know how long that will take. In a car, it's from Aspen to Denver, 5 hours, 6 hours.
My advice would be do less miles a day than you want to do. I mean, I've done some, I did a trip a couple of years ago where we did 400 miles a day. And it was all through California and up through the giant redwoods and across the Golden Gate Bridge and, you know, PCH and all the cliches, got all the cliches in, did deserts and forests and mountains. It's awesome.
Are you taking it all in when you're doing it, when you're on the bike?
Well,
that
actually, that was my point. I couldn't. I was going too fast. I was riding with two really good friends of mine who do those trips all the time. And one of them was on a KTM 1290 Adventure. Super fast, crazy bike. I was on a Triumph 1200 Scrambler. And my buddy at the back was on a Ducati Sport Classic 1000, which is the wrong bike for that trip. So I had all his luggage. I don't know why we didn't give all of our luggage to the KTM guy now I think about it. But David's very particular about his luggage. He'll laugh if he's listening. But we went too fast and we did too many miles. And so we were kickstands up at 8 o'clock in the morning and we got to our final destination at 8 o'clock in the evening because you do twisty roads. It's not motorway miles. And 400 miles on twisty roads where you're probably averaging 60 miles an hour. You might get up to 120, but your averages are much slower. Is knackering and it's exhausting and you're riding too fast and you're not looking at the mountains and the trees and the forest and the sea. So I would say don't do more than 250 miles a day and take long breaks, have a really nice breakfast, enjoy the moment, ride 100 miles and have an early lunch and really get comfortable and enjoy that. And then in your afternoon, have a nice break in the middle and turn up at your hotel, B&B, campsite, whatever, at 6 in the evening where you've got time to settle in and don't make it so that you're so tired that you go to sleep at 8:30 at night. You know, don't be knackered.
Yeah.
Enjoy it.
Yeah. Are you mic'd up when you're riding?
No.
So you're with three mates riding all day.
Yeah.
I mean, again, I know just mates who've done it, like a lot of them will mic up and be talking the whole way up. And I'm like, well, is that not defeating the point? Do you know what I mean? Like, I would have it where I'm not. Do you listen to music when you're doing it?
No, because I want to be in the moment. I never listen to music and I never connect my phone and I never use comms on a bike.
That's what I would hope. That's what I think. So when I'm thinking of that trip in America in the summer, I'm thinking like, you're just there, you and the road.
I think if I did have comms, apart from them being unintrusive, I'd have to have a really clear rules with the guys. We're not talking. This is not chat club. We're riding. You know, turn on the comms when you need a wee or petrol and there, or if something's gone wrong. Otherwise, shut the fuck up and ride. Because to me, you know, you get in harmony with people you ride with. I remember the three of us riding through these. It was a road at the base of these mountains. And so it was kind of going round them. It was like these big S's. And we were all three of us disappearing behind a rocky outcrop and then all three of us reappearing. It must have looked like a metronome, us going in and out and in and out. And we were vibing sort of behind each other at 100 meter intervals. And you felt locked in with these other guys.
No, it's so cool. I'm going to do it a little bit more. If the roads were better, in Edinburgh especially, I'd be out my bike more. I really would.
So. I hear there's great riding up in Scotland. I mean, I've not done it, but...
Yeah, they do something called the Highland Scramble.
Yeah,
well,
the roads look incredible. And Wales is amazing.
Yeah, I've heard Wales is really good.
Wales and Hereford are amazing roads there.
Yeah, and I mean, there's loads of good places. I know the weather, I keep mentioning that. But that's the thing in Scotland. I'm not a fan of going out in... when it's pishing it down, like smashing it down. It's just not as enjoyable. Do you know what I mean? I've spent 20 years out in the wet and cold, you know, like as in I want the sun. I get there's a bit where you, you know, you've got to earn your stripes.
Well, have you? I don't know. I think it's a bit of a thing. I mean, look, we all love to moan, right? We've talked about stacking supermarket shelves and, you know, work, you know, doing dodgy jobs and data wrangling. But at the end of the day, you know, we love to say we've earned our stripes, but at the end of the day, you don't have to be cold and miserable. I mean, I don't really get my bike out anymore. If it's less than 5 or 6 degrees, fuck it.
What's coming up then for the bike shed? The only one in Texas, because I could see myself as a GM. I've never done, well, I mentioned work behind the bar, done a bit of painting. If something comes up in Texas, I'll leave this all behind.
Dude, we would love to open this place in Texas, or a bike shed in Texas, 100%. Austin. We'd go to Austin. We've been looking at it. We've been looking at venues and properties and viability. And Atlanta as well. Problem is funding. We've got to find money. And, you know, we're down with OPM, other people's money. And that's how we function. We don't make enough profit if we make profit, we don't make the kind of profits that allow us to invest in new venues. So we need other people's money. And what we really need is we need a proper big angel investor to come in and go, right, let's go global. And then we do 10 of them. So that's...
Where would be the dream? Where would be the 10?
I think Austin, Atlanta, Lisbon, Barcelona, Tokyo, for sure. I mean, God, there's quite a big list. We probably should do one in Milan. It'd be rude not to. And Germany between Hamburg and Munich, or both. Those would be the next ones. And also, I'd love to be in the Middle East. I'd love to get further out. And we are actually looking at franchises. We're looking at a franchise model. And especially in places that are harder to get into, you know, like the Middle East or China or Asia, where you need partners, you need other people running the business. You can't just turn up, not unless you want to triple the cost. So that's certainly, we're focusing now on, we've built these two amazing venues. They're hard work. You know, they don't make a shit ton of money. They work. But what we really need to do is we need to scale up, and we need to go into places which actually might be profitable and might make a really strong global brand business. So that's the next step, finding the right backers to do that. And then, and in terms of literally what's next, our show at the end of the month. We were founded on our show, the Bike Shed Annual Motorcycle Show, which we now call the Bike Shed Moto Show, is our crown jewels, really. It's where we started. We started in 2013 with a show because it was at this big pop-up club. So we've got the show at Tobacco Dock. It's our 13th iteration of the show. It's the last bank holiday weekend in May, so 24th, 25th, 26th. And it's an epic event. It's the perfect place for non-riders who think bikes are cool to go. We'll have about 300 curated custom motorcycles and live music, loads of really good high-quality street food. I think we've got 7 bars. We'll be screening MotoGP. We've got sort of a podcast thing called Shed Talks.
Yeah, I was in there. I went to a couple of them.
The Shed Talks were good fun. We do record those, and they are actually on YouTube. And we did a really good one with Wade Eastwood last year, talking about sort of motorcycles in movies, which was brilliant because he's Tom Cruise's stunt coordinator. We did quite a few interesting ones. So all of that will be going on, and it's an awesome, awesome weekend of biking fun. And it's a really good event to go to, even if you've never ridden a motorcycle in your life. And it's affordable fun, and you can definitely spend all day there. So that's my focus for the next 4 weeks, is that show and getting it right and getting it good, and making sure people turn up.
And how do people get tickets?
So there's the main Bike Shed website at bikeshedmoto.co.uk, or .com will still take you there. And also we've got bikeshedmotoshow.com, or if you Google Bike Shed Show, it'll come up.
Yeah.
And then you buy tickets through Universe, which is a Ticketmaster company. And yeah, it's all very straightforward. And Tobacco Dock in Wapping is really easy to get to.
So
it's
cool there as well, isn't it?
Stone's throw from Tower Bridge. Yeah, it's a beautiful. You can't take a bad photo in that building. It's dockside. It's got those big masted dry docked ships in it. I mean, it looks beautiful. I mean, the place is absolutely stunning. It's so expensive.
Being expensive, I'm sure it is. I wonder back in the day whether they thought this place is going to be cool as shit. You know, like,
do you know
as in,
what? It was going to be a supermarket. It was going to be a giant mall, a shopping mall. In the 80s, that's what it was.
What a waste. Like, it's crazy, isn't it, that these places, edgy, gritty, dirty, but with that kind of history, are now the coolest places to go. Like, globally, like, it's the same when you go over to Brooklyn in, like, New York, where you go down the back streets, or Shoreditch as well. Like, all these places... that would have been like, there's no chance that these are restorable. Like, there's no chance. And look at them now.
Yeah. I mean, it's an absolutely stunning, stunning building and space. And, you know, we're always trying to look for a different venue to do it in, and we just can't find one. I love the venue. I love the place. It's just getting more and more expensive. They just put the prices up every year, and every year we're going, oh my God, we can't afford to
That's
do
not
it.
Sustainable, is it? This is what we speak to people in the industry, and again, it's not for me to quite call out or whatever, but it's just, it's crippling, isn't it? Because cool brands and innovation and people who are doing or thinking about whether or not it'd be coffee, whether or not it'd be craft lager, whether it'll be, you know, little pop-up things, even burger joints, you'd be like, fuck, you know what, forget it.
I think because, you know, we live in a capitalism has been really useful because it allows people to do things they wouldn't normally be able to do. It created the whole investment economy. I mean, I could go to a whole bunch of people, and between tax breaks and a bunch of people with too much money, I could create a corporate entity, get it invested in, and turn it into something cool and fun that's about humans and not about money. Money is not a product. It shouldn't be a product. Happy smiles are a product, and money's a fortunate outcome if you do a good job of it. But it's also created a culture where, for a lot of businesses, all they do is they count the money. They do think money's the product. And if you're in a big business where you're renting out space, or, you know, you're just looking at, you know, how you sort of repay your investors, you end up charging a lot of money, and you're not really interested in the cool brand or the artisan or the person that's trying to do something interesting. And, you know, there used to be sort of this idea of, you know, you'd let the funky cool brands come in and do it on the cheap, but it's all sort of gone away. I mean, I'd love to sort of go to the people we work with and say, look, you know, we may seem like this big business, but we are still sort of a mom and pop shop. And we are sort of, you know, it's pretty tough out there doing something niche. So, you know, throw us a bone and give us some good prices. But it's really hard. People just don't want to do it anymore.
Yeah. Well, hopefully it comes good, for sure. I'd love going down there. You're not open on a Monday, though. I'm always down in London on a Monday.
Yeah, I know. Well, there's no one about that.
I get it completely.
We had to close on Monday.
Yeah, it's the same. I stay at the Wolfpack Bar down in Fulham, and it's dead. You go in there, we've got people working behind the bar. We've got the chef in. No one's doing anything. It's like, now. Yeah. So don't open on a Monday just for me. Unless I pay you to
I
do
wish
it.
We could. I kind of gutted. We're not open on a Monday in LA either, and I sort of hate it. But it makes such a financial difference to not be open on a Monday.
Well, hopefully when we have this conversation again, I can be on your podcast with experiences that I've had. I'd love to be able to connect more. Do you know what I mean? As in talk about the ride from Aspen to Denver. And they call them, what they call them, Passovers. Is that what they call them?
Oh, I've never crossovers. Heard of
that. Oh, is it? Maybe it's an American thing. Yeah. It's a Passover. There's two Passovers that I'm going, but Dutch, I loved it. Massive fan of the brand. Like, love what you're doing. It's really cool. You need to do a podcast. You'll have some epic stories and guests, and I'd subscribe to it. But thank you for coming to the studio.
No, that was a genuine pleasure. And when I do a podcast, you're going to be a guest.
Awesome. Class.
Step onto the legendary clay courts of Roland Garros, where the world's best players battle it out for a chance to win the French Open title. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV, live in HD. Don't miss a moment with daily live coverage and match replays on demand, beginning Monday, May 20th. Be there for all the unforgettable moments. Stream now with Tennis Channel Plus.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.